GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in the areas of software-defined networking, evolved packet core, and more. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
I almost said it's 11:59 and 59 seconds. It's Saturday, April 12th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. I do like that dot matrix printer in there. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler.
Good morning.
Guten Morgen. And Lyle Troxell, a father, photographer, and software engineer.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, sir. Well, plenty of things to talk about today. I want to get to some little things first. Let's talk about the littlest one I can think of, fruit flies.
They're really annoying, aren't they? Well, they can be.
Do they make that sound too, like mosquitoes?
Yeah, they're pretty annoying. Especially if you have a compost pile in your house or something. Or pile in your house, but...
Or fruit you were hoping to get to.
Yeah, that's true.
But really intended to get to that. But.
Yeah. So I have an interesting story about what researchers at the University of Washington have done. Basically, they decided to use a high-speed camera to try and figure out how these flies fly.
Oh, they're pulling a Muybridge.
A Muybridge?
Edward Muybridge.
Oh, is that the horse guy?
Yeah, he's like the early photographer horse guy who was able to capture the movement of horse legs and so on.
The horse guy?
He
wasn't a horse guy. He just photographed a horse once.
Well, and some dudes running.
Which was difficult with hooves, you know?
Yeah.
Take a picture of
the horse guy.
The horse guy.
Oh, man. Anyway.
Someone's doing that for fruit flies?
Yeah. Except... It's not so fruit flies fly really, really fast, and they can navigate very, very quickly. Now, the idea behind the research was to figure out how do they navigate so quickly, and how do they make such sharp turns? Like if they suddenly decide that they're in danger, you're swatting at them, and they make what seems to be a 90-degree turn. It's kind of impressive. It's incredible to our eyes, and. So they actually captured these fruit flies at flying with a camera that was operating at 7,500 frames per second.
Wow. 7,500 frames per second.
Almost over 9,000.
When normal movies are what, 24 frames per second?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 24.
That's
or
fast.
30
that's fast.
On TV.
Okay.
And the flies normally flap their wings about 200 times a second, which means that we got a lot of frames per wing flap.
Cool.
So it's actually some pretty cool footage. Now, the things that they found, for example, that fruit flies actually make turns very similar to jet fighters, where they will actually bank their bodies, like turn their bodies and make a banked turn just very, very quickly. What really stood out to me about this, though, was just mainly a couple of the things that they had to do to make this happen and a couple of the facts that are in this article. So first of all, these flies are flying around and they're avoiding obstacles and trying to figure out like what is a danger to them, right? What poses a threat?
Yeah, the giant fly swatter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Their brains are the size of a grain of salt.
So wow.
Not much processing power.
And they can somehow do this. It's remarkable to me. And then another thing is how do you photograph something with a high-speed camera? You have to blast it with light because every single one of these individual frames is 1/30,000th of a second. Mm-hmm. So you need a lot more light for the camera to be able to pick it up.
Okay.
So instead of just turning these ridiculously high-powered floodlights
just
on these...
Just burning the flies?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a problem.
We got great photos of flies falling from the sky.
Incineration.
Now we know how fast flies can die.
Another thing is, if you remove the heat aspect of it, these flies rely on their vision.
Oh, yeah.
So they're just like, they can't see.
Can't see.
You blind these flies, and then they don't do what you want them to do, which you want to try and observe them naturally.
So how'd they do it?
How did they do it, Ben?
As it turns out, fruit flies and humans cannot see in the infrared, but cameras can.
Cool.
In fact, if you take your phone camera and you point it at the business end of a remote control, you'll actually see a little red light flashing whenever you press the button. And that's because it's actually sending out infrared light, which the camera can pick up, but your eyes cannot. Oh. Same with fruit flies. So they got these, I guess they must have been these massive floodlights that you turn them on and you don't see anything happen.
Nice.
But it's actually a massive amount of infrared light. And so, the cameras were able to capture that. And it's a really, also just as a, from the Geek Pit perspective, it's a really cool video.
I can't wait to see it at geekspeak.org.
If only the radio allowed us to see.
If only.
Well, your description helped me a lot, so I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Also, have you ever seen a fruit fly up close?
No.
No, but I have heard that animals, a fruit fly is the most studied animal on the planet because we use them so much.
Because they die nicely, nice and quickly.
They reproduce quickly and die quickly.
That's horrible. That's horrible. I have to say,
the whole life cycle.
They are weird. They are weird looking.
Yeah.
They're. It's just strange, you know. Like when you
and you can grow them too. Just get some fruit and put it in a bowl.
Yeah.
That's not how you grow a fruit fly. That's how you attract
them. They spontaneously generate from the dead fruit.
That's what they used to think.
Yeah. We're far more advanced than that. All right. So interesting video at geekspeak.org after the show.
Yes, indeed.
See a fruit fly close up doing weird things. Hey, Lyle, can you tell me what's going on in 3D printing?
Oh, yeah. So we all know 3D printing is on the move, and it's quite exciting. You can take a computer object that is three dimensions, and you can send it to a printer, and the printer will actually slowly build that object in physical space, and you can pick it up. And normally the materials are kind of plastics or ceramic-y type stuff. Staples has a service where you can go in and have them print stuff, and they're selling printers. So this is mainstream, baby.
Staples. Oh, my
gosh. They'll print it for you?
Yeah.
And then they're also selling printers.
Yeah, so they're selling printers, and they don't stock printers in their stores, but they'll ship them to them or you for free. So you can go in, and there's, like, printers are just above $1,000, 3D printers.
Yeah.
And that's the rate. But they also have the service where you can go in and talk to somebody at the store and actually have them print it, and they will print an object for you, which is cool. There's actually a website for the Netherlands stores where you can actually upload your file and have them print it and then pick it up at that store. Like, you know, like a photo booth kind of thing where you used to do photos in a store.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, but with 3D objects. In any case, 3D printing, very mainstream. I thought it was kind of cool that Staples was doing that. I haven't actually gone and tried the service, but I'm going to have to because that's too cool.
Now we have to.
And I'm assuming that Kinko's, Xerox, whatever that company is now that owns like 50 things.
Yeah.
Kinko's is this copy center that we've had here for a long time.
Right.
I'm assuming they'll catch on and do it quick too.
Yeah. Staples was first. I wasn't expecting that.
I thought that was pretty cool.
I wasn't expecting. I mean, yeah.
Look at that. Hey, speaking of printing things out,
I've got one.
I wonder if Staples can handle something very, very large. Let's go from the small to the large, Ben.
All right. Well, I've actually got two stories about planes, and the first one is about printing them. Now, this is not printing a full-size plane. That would be a little difficult.
Oh. I thought it was about printing a full-size plane.
No. This plane...
I need to get somewhere fast.
When you put it together...
Staples, would you mind? I'd like it in blue.
How big is your parking lot?
Did you actually know that the paint on planes weighs a lot? And
why?
So,
because there's a lot of plane?
It's just heavy. There's a lot of plane. You have to cover the entire plane in this paint, and you got to make it so it doesn't flake off while you're flying.
But is the paint on a plane heavier than the paint on a house? It's like really dense paint.
Well, he's saying it has to be super sticky paint.
Okay. I'm not sure.
But if you take just the paint on a plane, that weighs a lot is what you're saying.
Basically, if you look at planes, you'll find that very, very few airlines have painted their planes solid colors. Most of them have very, very minimal paint jobs, which just kind of give you enough to have it look different than other airlines.
And the rest of it is?
Just not.
Metal.
It's
white. Normally, isn't white paint?
There's something different about white paint.
Okay.
There's no pigment in it.
So the colored paint is heavy.
Moving on.
I didn't.
There's actually a lot of exposed aluminum, but go on.
Yeah. So I didn't look that up before the show.
Anyway.
Anyway, if someone wants to call in and
geek factoids off the top of our heads.
On plane paint.
Woodbridge.
Well, anyway, the plane that I'm talking about has a wingspan of 1.5 meters, which is almost 5 feet.
Okay.
And it weighs 4.5 pounds or 2 kilograms. So it's really lightweight and it's actually pretty wide. And you can actually print it using ABS plastic, which is the cheap way of doing it.
Yeah.
So in the past, we've had groups printing 3D planes, and they've been using like Ultem resin, which is much more expensive, mm-hmm. and using different printing techniques. This is the kind of 3D printing technique that you would think of, where a little head, a nozzle, moves around in a shape and just kind of spits out this.
It's like a very hot glue gun slowly over time.
Exactly.
Ben, why is this important? And is this for like creating new designs for airplanes?
Well, actually, the story here is that normally, if you wanted to print something like what they printed, it would take 120 hours. But they actually got it down to 24.
Okay.
So you can actually produce all of the different components. There are 9 components. You kind of have to put them together, snap them together. But it takes less than 24 hours to print.
Yeah.
And so you can go from it, basically, the cool thing is you can go from it basically not existing to flying through the air in less than 24 hours. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Rather than 5 days.
Or I'm thinking the old school way of taking some balsa wood and a Zacto blade and some glue and spending a month. You print out your design and you glue it down to balsa wood sheets and then you slowly slice it out. Like, that's how you used to make your first model airplane. And then you pick it up and it's been a month and you've throw it and it falls.
Meow.
You're like, darn.
Well, cussing ensues.
Starting in. But now you can do that quickly.
Paper is a good medium.
Yeah.
You can make a paper airplane and like, well, I'll just do it right now.
So that's one way you can share a plane is by going, hey, here's some plans and someone can print it out.
Mm-hmm.
What's another way of sharing a plane, Ben?
There is another way of sharing a plane. There's a new company called Airpooler, which actually lets you carpool, but with a plane.
I thought about swimming when you said pooler.
Airpooler.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to think carpools were actually like deluxe limousines with swimming pools in them. That's what I thought when I was 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah.
Cruise ships have swimming pools.
There was no such thing as carpool lanes when I was 5 or 6. Go on. What do you mean? How would you share it?
Like private
sharing,
planes?
Yeah, we're not talking about sharing a 747.
Hey, Bonnie, want to go for a ride?
That's called commercial airline industry.
And you get treated like horribly.
Yeah.
So
what's this?
We're talking about sharing like a little Cessna or something, like a two-seat airplane that some hobbyist has learned to fly and is, renting a Cessna or has his own plane or her own plane. And apparently 20 to 25% of private pilots are doing some sort of sightseeing trip, and the rest of them actually are going to a specific destination. If you happen to want to go to where they want to go, why not go up
into
the air with them?
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, it does seem a little harrowing to go into the air with some... there's one pilot. There's no co-pilot.
With that captain from Loft.
I need extra money. I'm going to Bakersfield. Hi. Get on.
Some shabby dude in a five-o'clock shadow.
I just imagine you hitchhiking by the runway, just, a sign.
Sure, I'll get in a plane with you.
So,
yeah, sounds good.
Now, all jesting aside, this is actually kind of an interesting idea. And again, the company is called Airpooler, and they're just kind of getting off the ground. But, I just thought it was an interesting
very
story.
Cool. Sharing
but
a plane.
Zip planes, but different.
Just like, yeah, except you own the plane. It's like, what's it called? Lyft. Where Lyft with a Y, that is.
Yeah.
Where someone owns a car and then they
give you a Lyft.
Exactly. Or
it's
Uber.
Like that.
Yeah.
Right.
It's gone to the planes. Next, big old boats. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, Fadi Joda is a humanitarian doctor who's worked in emergency rooms and refugee camps. He's also a Palestinian American whose own parents were refugees too, and he's an award-winning poet. He's going to talk to host Robert Pauly about his hyphenated identity, the lives of exiles, and the struggle to capture that multiplicity in verse. That's the next 7th Avenue Project, Sunday at noon here on 88.9 KUSP. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. And now let's get to the big story of the week, the heartbleed. What is this heartbleed? What is this Heartbleed? What is it?
What a wonderful logo it has and tons of press coverage. And
yeah, how'd they get a logo already? I came up with that.
You know, it's funny, these stories that kind of hit like this. Somebody made a logo and then it just goes everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's got that like heart that's bleeding that's kind of an outline
of a heart.
It's everywhere.
It's amazing.
So since we're the bridge from geeks to the rest of humanity, I thought we would actually try to let people understand what is actually happening with this vulnerability.
Oh, I appreciate it because I'm a little unclear myself.
And then a little bit later, we'll talk about what you can actually, how it might affect you and what you can actually do to help remediate the problem.
I'm also very keenly interested in that subject.
So let's first talk
this
about...
This is going to work out very well for me.
There's a lot of talk about, in these stories, people bring up the term protocol, and a protocol is just a way of communicating. And we actually have a protocol, Bonnie. Mm-hmm. I thought we would go ahead and use one of a protocol that everyone knows about.
Yeah.
And that is the protocol of making a phone call. Okay. So when I call you and your phone is ringing, what would you do with your phone ringing?
I pick it up and I say, hello, this is Bonnie.
Okay. I go, hi, it's Lyle. How you doing?
Oh, hi, Lyle.
And then you might ask me how I'm doing. You might not. But that little bit that we just did is the start of almost every phone call.
Yeah.
Sometimes you wouldn't say your name, and then I'd say, is this Bonnie?
Well,
and sometimes
true.
I wouldn't say my name right away. I'd say, hey, Bonnie, I was thinking about doing this. And then a minute later you go,
excuse me, who's this?
Who is this? Right? So we have other cues we can use because we can recognize voices, and we have a chance. Oh, it's Saturday. You're probably calling me at the show, so it's probably Bonnie. You know. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, now our phones actually give the name, and we could actually get rid of that whole thing. So lots of times when I pick up the phone, I'll say, hi, it's Lyle. Hi, Bonnie. Because I saw your voice, your caller ID.
Right.
So this protocol that we have for phone calls actually changes over time based on technology.
Right.
Notice.
Yeah.
And context.
If Ben calls me, he will never say, hi, it's Ben. Because he knows that I know it's him because of the phone conversation.
Because the phone thing. Right?
When I'm doing this with my mother, she might not get that her phone is telling me who she is. So it, of course, is depending on how you update your protocol or not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay, understood.
So 2 years ago, a request for comments, this is an RFC, is a document that kind of defines protocols for the internet and for computers in general. And when we say request for comments, it's this wonderful, I love the idea that it's a request for comments because it's not, this is the right way to do it. It's a, hey everybody, does everyone think this is a cool idea? What do you think?
Okay.
That's how open source protocols get defined,
which is really neat. People weigh in and go, what if it was tweaked here and this needs a bell?
Right, and they respond to it and somebody else responds to it, and eventually you get a document that people stop responding to because look good. Thumbs up.
Okay. Yeah.
So 2 years ago that happened, and what got added in is an extra feature to this protocol that we use a lot, which is called, at the time was called SSL, and during that time it switched to TLS, and that stands for Transport Security Layer, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is the thing that you use to communicate with your bank with a website. Okay? We're going to do a little bit more of that later.
The secure connections.
So it'd be like, hey, Vanguard, it's Bonnie. What's up?
Yeah, when you're talking to your bank.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So in this protocol, the addition that was added was this idea that, you know, when you and I make that telephone call, if we were to be disconnected or we hang up or something, and then you call back, it's almost weird not to do that all again, right? You and I... Every time you answer the phone, you say, hi, it's Bonnie. I say, hi, it's Lyle calling. How you doing? I'm good.
Yeah.
That little bit of stuff takes some time.
Yeah.
In the secure sockets layer, the transport security layer, that bit of time, it makes a lot of sense to reduce that. Because the more you reduce that, the more your server can handle.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was, hey, you know, what we could do is we'd add this new feature that's basically an ability for us to continually keep that conversation open.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that looks like for you and I, let's say you and I do that phone call conversation, and what we're doing is we're actually working on something. So you're reading an email, you want to give me some information back or something.
Yeah.
And during that time, you might go, okay, just a second. And I go, are you there? Yeah. And we kind of keep the phone call going on, even though nothing's being said, really.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that is the protocol addition that was called the heartbeat. And it basically was just that. It was just still here. Still here.
Still there?
Still here. Every once in a while.
Yeah.
And that just allowed us not to have the beginning of the conversation again.
Right. Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So it's a good feature.
Okay.
It's actually a really important feature on top of some other protocols, the TCP and UDP stack, that actually do those things differently. And this allowed the same type of keep alive concept, the heartbeat concept, on top of a UDP protocol. But I'm not going to get into that today.
Okay.
That's just for the geekier minds out there.
Just got some acronym sound.
Yeah, exactly.
There. Okay.
So that was the addition. The flaw. Now, Ben, you got a great description of this flaw from go ahead and describe the flaw.
Sure. Yeah. And actually, I'm taking this directly from the XKCD comic. If you don't know XKCD, it's a wonderful webcomic. It's the only one I ever read. And it's very, very geeky.
Oh, there's so many good webcomics out there, Ben.
But this is
everybody
so
send
good.
Email Ben good webcomics.
Oh, yeah.
His email
sure.
is ben@geekspeak.org.
I will read. Gets him. What if I want to see
okay,
him?
geeks@geekspeak.org.
I will read at least one from every link that anyone sends me.
Oh, that's very sweet.
I'm automating that puppy.
I want to see
so,
that. Yeah.
So I'm gonna.
So XKCD. Now we're gonna have this up at geekspeak.org too. So
you
want to
see
this later, you can.
But we're gonna just act it out. So Bonnie, you're gonna be the server, okay?
Okay.
So I say, hey server, are you still there? If so, reply potato. That's six characters.
Okay. Potato.
Hey server, are you still there? If so, reply bird. That's four characters.
Okay. You want four letters, so bird.
Hey server, are you still there? If so, reply hat.
Okay, so you want
hat is 500 letters.
500 letters. All right. So hat. Oh, Lucas requests the missed connections page. Eve, the administrator, wants to set server's master key to 148.35.038.534.
So you started. So Bonnie, you started with the word hat, but he told you that it was a lot longer.
It's 500 characters. So I was just going 500 characters worth of hat, but there was all this other interesting information.
So I guess all that stuff was in Bonnie's brain. She was thinking about those things.
Yeah. Basically.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's
so Bonnie the server is not just responding to my request. Bonnie is responding to Lyle's requests and the administrator's password change requests mm-hmm. and all of these other requests. If by chance Bonnie if I do something like this, which could be malicious, and Bonnie responds with information that's interesting to me, maybe a username and password combination, now all of a sudden I have access to privileged information that Bonnie shouldn't have let go.
Right. So the interesting problem there was that heartbeat that you guys were doing, hey, if you're there, still there, respond to hat and all these things, had that little number in there, mm-hmm. and that little number you could increase, and that was the vulnerability. Okay. So the heartbeat thing was perfect, right? You guys were doing exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
You were getting a response from Bonnie whenever you needed one, a heartbeat, if you will. Unfortunately, of this bug, Bonnie's brain
checking.
Just got dumped into your system.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the vulnerability actually actually spits out 64K of RAM of the processor. Now, we've talked before on GeekSpeak about buffer write overload, and this is a vulnerability where you can start executing programs on a computer by taking advantage of the same problem. Here, store this to memory, and it's a lot bigger than the space available, and it overwrites, and that is it's a common way of accessing a computer. You've heard overwrite vulnerability?
No, look at my little eyebrows going up. What?
So this is an overread where you say, I want this much information, and it's asked for it at a certain location. The computer starts at that location, but you told it to go longer, and
exactly.
it just keeps on going.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So the major problem of this, the problem of this is that what's in RAM of a computer is, from a design perspective, private. Inherently, it's supposed to be private. And therefore, it's not protected anyway. In fact, it can't be protected.
Yeah, you can't. Okay, so if you store something on a hard drive or if you store something in some data store, you could encrypt that information.
Mm-hmm.
But once it's in the RAM of the computer is actually using it. It's actually interacting with it. So it can't be encrypted.
Yeah.
That's the computer's working memory. So the computer has to unencrypt a password or a username or some information and then hang on to that while it's working with it. And then theoretically, of course, once it's done, it goes out of the RAM and then nobody has access
to it. In fact, this is how dangerous RAM is. When you submit password to a website, there's a whole encryption thing that gets the password to the server. The server then takes the password and for a moment it's in RAM.
Mm-hmm.
Then
unencrypted.
Then it hashes it, which is a type form. It's similar encryption,
but
it makes
that before.
Right?
Yeah.
And then it looks for that hash in a database. But for a moment, it's actually in RAM. It's just like
it's
you typed
totally
it on your computer.
It's in totally readable form.
Right.
Anyone could get at.
And specifically, that's the only time it's unreadable is when it's in RAM.
Yeah.
And this vulnerability allows you to look at RAM remotely. Anybody can look at RAM.
Yeah.
And specifically, it targets web servers which are public to the internet. So basically, with this vulnerability, you could go to any web server and say, hey, give me 64K of your RAM. That's why it's so serious.
Now,
is it a perfectly innocent mistake that led to
yes.
this thing?
Well,
or did
yeah,
someone go, hey, here's how I could get into computers?
The developer that wrote the bug, it's open source, the developer wrote the bug, responded that no, it was not intentional, completely accident, and it doesn't look even as crazy as the Apple flaw we talked about. It looks like a traditional mistake in programming.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
common,
absolutely.
I would say.
And so then do we know that people are using it for evil?
They are now.
Okay.
Yeah, exploits are in the wild now.
Yeah. And there
came out on the 7th. It became public on the 7th.
Okay.
Some undisclosed sources also said that the NSA has been using it for years.
NSA has denied that. The president's looked into the thing and said denied it. So there's a lot of debate whether it was or not. There's no.
So who knows?
It's up in the air.
I mean, everyone likes to accuse the NSA of everything these days.
Yeah.
So that's not to say they did or didn't, but it's quite possible. Another thing that's important just to note that we haven't said is this is not any web server. This is only web servers that are using this particular technology called OpenSSL.
That's right.
Which gets to my next question is how vulnerable are we really?
So we've been talking kind of technical for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm Lyle. I just want to get people down to a base because we've got a good base there, but what actually happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. So should we fill something with something else or do you want to keep going, Bonnie? Do you like this?
Well, I think everyone that is like me is thinking, okay, so do I really have to change all my passwords because I barely remember them? And in fact, I have changed a couple and have not remembered them, and it's flummoxing.
And that's problematic too, right?
Yeah, yeah. What do I really have to do now?
All right. One of the recommendations that happened on the 7th or 8th was stay off the internet for a while.
Which was a bit crazy.
But also kind of beautiful, right?
Yeah.
Go do something else. I mean, that's great, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There are some other
watercolor paper, go for a walk, call a grandma. You know, there's lots of other things to do in the world.
Mm-hmm. Guess I'll write a letter.
The trouble with this system is that it used to be that when you wanted to make sure that TLS was happening, and when you were doing that, your conversation was private, and you knew from the protocol who it was on the other end. Mm-hmm. You knew it was the bank that you were talking to, mm-hmm. because that's part of it. It's not just authentication. It's not just it's authentication. It's also identity of the bank, right?
Yeah.
So what's happened is with this vulnerability, other people can have the key, the private key of the bank that says they're the bank. So therefore, because they could have that, anybody could have any of these, the banks are all changing their security code. They're all updating. They're all fixing this. Mm-hmm. Also, as Ben, you mentioned that a lot of sites aren't being affected by this.
Yeah, like actually most of the – so there is a list. It's called the Heartbleed Hit List. Mashable put it out on the 9th.
We'll have that up
April.
On geekspeak.org.
That'll be up on geekspeak.org. You can see, like, for example, Facebook was affected and Gmail was affected. But if you go down to the banks section, it turns out – actually, when I checked it last night, none of the banks on that list were affected by this because none of them were using the affected versions of OpenSSL.
And that makes a lot of sense. Microsoft web server, which is a really large portion, does not use this tool.
Okay.
It's used in Apache and Nginx, which are used in open source mostly. So it's used a lot. I use it on the sites that I use. I don't have any SSL certs right now that are active, so I don't have to worry about this. But additionally, do you remember a few years ago when everyone was saying every website should be SSL, but they actually mean TLS? So Facebook switched to inherently always using HTTPS.
Which, Google switched, that's the lock.
The little lock, right? Mm-hmm. That happened a few years ago.
Yeah.
What we've just redone is we've kind of reset everything to kind of be before that happened. Because without SSL, without having that little lock on, this thing has nothing to do with your life, right? Adding the lock, the secure sockets layer, the SSL, TLS, adding that feature now allows this problem to happen where you can then do something exactly like if you didn't have the lock.
The move to get more secure made us more vulnerable.
No, what I'm saying is, the worst case scenario is we are now exactly like we were before TLS.
Here's a metaphor.
It's not horrible.
Okay. Here's a metaphor. Let's say we all live in Canada and nobody locks their doors, right? And then
Canada.
Canada seems awesome like that.
Yeah, you can email Ben at Ben.
Right. So let's say that nobody locks their doors, right? This is 2 years ago. And then all of a sudden, everyone is saying, hey, you really should have a lock on your door.
And so everyone puts locks on their doors.
Everybody puts locks on their doors. And then all of the locks made by certain manufacturers, mm-hmm. it turns out 2 years later, we discover that if somebody has a specially shaped key,
Or a paperclip. Please let me in your house.
Someone with a honeyed tone.
They could make it into your house,
right?
So you're just as insecure as you were 2 years ago when you didn't have any locks on your house. Actually, you're probably more secure because the people who are trying to break into your house need to know that they can exploit this bug, and they need to know what your lock is.
Right.
And so that's kind of the issue. Also, there are a lot of places that you've added locks, and those locks are fine. Right.
Okay. So the thing that's a little different about this is that what we've been saying from a security and from a geek perspective is make sure you've got a lock. Now you have to say, make sure you have a lock. Make sure that the lock is not an old lock. And then you'll be okay. And the trouble with that is that we don't want to have to explain to people how to check to see if the new certs are working, right? So that's kind of the problem.
But is that what companies are doing? Like,
that's
what companies
are doing.
If I have a website and I went for the lock and it turns out to be the wrong lock, then I'm taking care of that.
That's right.
But
the problem with this is that this also identifies what house it is, right?
Yeah.
And what's happened is because of that identification thing, online you can actually pose as a different web server. So Bonnie, right now you're connected to the internet through a Wi-Fi access point that I'm also connected to.
Yeah.
And when you say, hey, DNS server, I want bankofamerica.com, whatever, some server out there tells you where on the internet it is, then you get that IP address, then you go to that address.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm on the same network as you, I can respond faster to that request for DNS. And I can say, oh, Bank of America? Yeah, that's right over here. And then your machine, instead of going to Bank of America, is going to go to me.
Mm.
If the secure layer was actually working correctly, you'd see a warning from your browser going, whoa, 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 this person is not Bank of America. This person has a fake security identification. But if I went and got the real security identification from Bank of America because of this vulnerability, and I had that, there'd be no way for your computer to know that I wasn't lying.
So
and that man-in-the-middle attack is what we're talking about,
is now
possible because of this. Additionally, it's possible for years after this, even if the Bank of America fixes their certificate, because all I have to do is be in the middle and have that one valid one that was valid for a while. And that's the problem, is that there's no way to recover from that.
Now I'm more scared.
It's kind of scary.
So you need to – what do you have to do? You have to tell your browser to update certs, right?
Well, don't do banking from a Wi-Fi access point. Because that man in the middle requires me to be in the middle of your communication at the same level as you.
Yeah.
For years, we thought, you know what? If you're connected to your telco, your cable company, whatever, from home, no one was connected to your Wi-Fi access point, but you just plugged right in, and you were talking to Bank of America, you had to trust your cable company, your ISP, to not eavesdrop, because they could technically.
Mm-hmm.
And there's safety. But apparently, it's really safe. Except that now we know, because of the Snowden leaks, that the U.S. government is actually sucking up all this data all the time anyway. And the only thing that was protecting us was that those certificates were actually proving who you were talking to. And now that proof doesn't work. So it's kind of like it's a collection of problems. In general, I think if you're from your home or if you're from a Wi-Fi point where no one else is connected, you're totally fine because there's no one in there intercepting. That's my guess.
Well, right, because like I have Wi-Fi at home, but I'm really the only one who uses it.
Hopefully.
And I've got security key and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, right? You have a security... And you want to be using the most recent security protocol because that actually does encrypt the communication that people can't listen in. And the man-in-the-middle attack actually requires them to be writing to the network as well as they're listening. So this is a meaty subject, as we can tell.
Is anyone feeling better?
So what? So what do you do?
Yeah, what do we do?
In the TLS protocol, the protocol about this, there's actually a way to revoke an old certificate. First of all, certificates are not forever. After about 2 years from now, all the certificates that were potentially compromised and could be used against you will expire. And your browser will say, this certificate's expired. Don't ignore that. Pay attention to that. When it says expired, you're not really talking to your bank. So over a period of time, this will be fine. This will help you right now. The other thing you can do is you can actually tell your browser to always check to see if the certification has been revoked.
How do I do that?
Okay. There's a few steps to it. We'll put it up on geekspeak.org. I think that's the best way to do it. Actually, I'll link to an article about how to do that. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that's going to slow your communications down a bit.
Because you always have to go, yes, I really meant to go to that website.
Well, what the revocation is inside that certificate you get from Bank of America, every one that was ever written, hopefully in there it says, check to see if this is revoked at this site. And so Ben's sitting over here, and he's got a copy from the real Bank of America that says, this certificate is bad. And inside the certificate that I stole from Bank of America and you're now using to access my computer and you think I'm Bank of America, you look inside that and it says, talk to Ben first before you trusting this. So instead of just trusting it, like your browser would say, you instead make another communication to Ben. You say, hey, Ben, I got this one. Is it still good? And Ben says,
no.
And that's revocation. That's a revocation service that's built in the protocol. So
how does that look in effect if you're tapping away?
Inside of preferences of your browser, you can say always check revocation.
Yep.
And if you do that, your browser will check for you. Now, unfortunately, it's not required to have revocation. Banks always do it, but it's not required to have it in the certificate. So we'll have a little bit more growth about the solution to this as time goes by.
Okay.
The changing the password thing, that's the next big thing. Should you go and change your password?
I know.
Right?
And when?
Yeah.
Right? Because if they haven't gotten around to it or they're still working on it, then I could just change the password.
So
go
to Ben's list to see mm-hmm. who's fixed it, right? Does that list have a fixing or not?
Yes, it does. It says, let's say Facebook, for example. Was Facebook affected? It says unclear or yes or no. In this case, it says unclear. Is there a patch? Yes. Do you need to change your password? Yes. If it says, is there a patch? No, or unclear, or something like that, that means you should wait until there's a patch before you change your password.
Right. So right. Go to the site, and if there's a patch, go change your password now.
But it's been a week.
And so I highly suggest the password thing. Mm-hmm. Let's take this opportunity to change your password because it's a good thing to do. But
well,
switch
that's
to-
the point because I had like one of my websites, I had just kind of like a couple of words spelled out that they were short. And they said, oh, yeah, now your password has to be 8 characters and there has to be some capitalizing. There has to be some numbers. So necessarily now my password has to be more secure than it was before.
Okay, Bonnie, I got a question for you.
Okay.
Do you remember all your passwords?
Well, I try to do variations on a thing.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, none of us can actually memorize them. So I've been I've been saying for years on GeekSpeak that it's time now to not be the brain behind the password.
I've been hearing you say it,
too. So what I suggest is take this opportunity to grab something like 1Password or LastPass or another password manager that works on your phone as well as your machine, as your computer, because you want it on both.
Yeah.
Then use a service to sync them. LastPass actually is that service. They were very responsive in this problem that emerged. In fact, their customer data was never taken advantage of. Which is really cool.
So you're fine.
If you're using LastPass. I think I'm going to push for LastPass instead of 1Password, even though I personally use 1Password. LastPass is a cheaper service to use, but either of them are fine. What these services do is they make your password for you. They make it really good. It's a random key. They put it in the web page for you. It's a bookmark thing, and it inserts it in the web page. You say yes. They save that information. Then they sync it to all your devices. So later on when you want to log into geekspeak.org, instead of having to know the password, you have to have your LastPass access. If you have the LastPass access, which has a password, of course, which is long, but it's only one of them, inside there will be actually a real password for geekspeak.org, and that will auto-insert for you, and you'll be logged in. If you do this, you'll be a lot better, and your life will be easier.
So, takeaway, for Mother's Day, go and set your mother up with LastPass or 1Password or whatever. Same thing for Father's Day.
Well, fathers have to wait, though.
Yeah, fathers later. Have to wait. They don't get good security yet.
Unless they raised you by themselves.
Man, that was
a topic. They get both. You know what? It's time. It's time to stop talking about Heartbleed.
I'm ready.
My heart is hurting.
My brain is full. So, yeah, Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Primsch talking with Ben Jaffe and Lyle Troxell, and we're now taking your calls with questions and comments. You may have some about anything we've been chatting about today.
I was trying to say. That was perfect.
The number is 800-655-5877. Once again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Lyle, you got your glass on again, your Google Glass.
I do. Oh, my gosh. I took a picture and you said you got your glass on, and it actually worked on my registration of my Google Glass, and now it wants to share it with somebody. So nicely done. Mm-hmm.
Did I just make you vulnerable?
You did. I feel very exposed.
It's your own fault for wearing it.
That's right. So Google Glass is this, elite technical thing that I've had for almost a year.
Yeah.
And I have it because, well, it is. You can't get it. It's this kind of a pain. I've had people say, can I, buy them? I'm like, no. And I had some invites for a while. When I did actually invite 5 people, nobody that I knew actually wanted to spend
$1,500
to get this thing on your face.
That's a lot of money.
Except for companies that are doing ads, apps. And that's actually why I have it, right?
Oh, because you can develop stuff.
You're developing stuff. It's really in some
ways.
And superhuman people that are like jumping out of airplanes and stuff that have tons of money.
Yeah,
and,
the Bransons.
Have their own planes. Yeah. Then they just buy it because why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
If they can get to it.
Add to my collection.
So now you don't have to have an invite. You can actually buy Google Glass yourself, but only for one day.
What?
Sounds like a press stunt to me.
I know. What a bizarre.
And it's
they actually want to make this in,
It's tax day too. April 15th.
On tax day.
On April 15th, you can go to the site and you can buy it. And
that's incentive to get your taxes done before April 15th.
If you have to find out if you can do that.
And just see if at all possible if you can get a refund.
Yeah.
I could not.
You can get emailed a reminder if you want. But, if I didn't have Google Glass right now and it was my own $50 would I buy it on
that's
the 50?
A good question.
Like, that's the question.
Would you
I'd
plunk
no.
down $1,500 of your dollars, Lyle Trotsell's?
Well, Ben, are you
going to
buy it? Are you going to buy it? You could buy it.
Oh, no.
Bonnie
no.
going to buy it?
No, no.
no.
You know, if it was $200, I wouldn't buy it because I think it takes something away from the face-to-face communication.
If it was $200, I'd buy seven of them.
Now, wait a second. So your I don't know.
It takes away from our it takes away from personal communication.
So your experience right now is experiencing glass as something that's there when you need it, right?
It's barely noticeable to me.
And that's fantastic, right? You just don't see it when you don't need it and you see it when you do. I see it all the time.
When you look at me.
When
I look
at you.
It's on your face, man.
Yeah. So you know, you walked into the station and the first thing I notice is, oh, it's Lyle. The second thing I notice is he's wearing glass or he's not wearing glass.
Let me ask you this.
So
look at Bonnie.
There. Yeah. So
she's wearing glasses.
Glasses.
Yeah, but the only reason they're different is because you think of them as different.
No. Because
Bonnie's, my glasses can't record him.
And there's not.
But Bonnie's glasses cover more of her face than mine.
But it's not about how much of your face it covers. It's about how it changes our interaction.
Yeah, and that's only being changed because it's an alien thing in your mind.
No. Our interaction has changed if you pull out your cell phone from your pocket.
But
are our
interactions change when Bonnie's wearing glasses versus not wearing glasses?
No, but her glasses don't light up when she gets a tweet.
But keep in mind that my partner only wears reading glasses, right? And so she almost never wears glasses when we're out and about and looking at each other and stuff. But when she's reading, she'll put them on. So then if I happen to be sitting next to her and she's wearing them and she looks at me, then she starts examining my pores. And the interaction definitely changes, I have to say. In fact, I feel vulnerable. Now, she's not tweeting it, but...
You can defend Google Glass
difference.
All you want, Lyle.
I didn't even mean to do that. I'm so sorry. I feel so embarrassed. I just like the technologies.
You just like it. So, if you want to and you've got $1,500 burning a hole in your pocket in this economy, knock yourself out and buy yourself a pair of Google Glass before Ray-Ban has really had a chance to come up with some cool designer frames. I don't get it.
There are designer frames, not by Ray-Ban, but there are designer frames now. But you should look
Ray-Ban?
At them and tell us if you think they're
any good. I forget who the guy was. There's some outfit.
Oh, there's some outfit.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Ray-Bans, I think Ray-Bans were.
So that already happened?
Not
I thought they just announced that they were starting to develop.
Things on Geekspeak that don't matter. I'm sorry. I'm so addicted to Google Glass. I'm sorry, you guys. As friends of your, I mean, I'm sorry that I wear them all the time.
Okay.
I feel really embarrassed right now, but I'm not taking them off.
All right. Duly noted. So what's the day?
Oh, the 15th. Day. Oh, I'm sorry. So today's the 12th, so it's Tuesday?
3 days. Yeah. Okay. Hey, it looks like we've got a call from Scott, and we're going to get to that in just a second because I wanted to hear something. You mentioned off air, Ben, that there's something going on with double-blind violin studies.
Yeah, I mean, we were just talking about the very, 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 very new and expensive. I want to talk about the very, 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 very old and expensive, specifically Stradivarius violins.
Now, these are the good ones, right?
Those are the good ones.
Those are like the ones that have some magical, amazing somethingness about
them.
They
were made by the guy, Stradivarius.
They're made
Stradivarius.
By Mr. Antonio Stradivari, who died in 1737. So there are a very limited number of these.
You cannot get more of them.
You do not get to buy
a
new one.
They're not open to.
They're
just
not
do
available on the
15th
of April.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. You can buy one, and I'll tell you the price tag at the end of this story. But so for years, for decades, people have been saying, "What is it that makes these violins so much better than new violins?" Or by violins by his contemporaries or things, and of course the implicit assumption is that people, at least players, if not everybody, can tell the difference between a Stradivari and or Stradivarius and a new violin. Well, there have been some studies, and the most recent one is actually a double-blind study asking players if they can tell the difference between these violins and other ones. Double-blind means not. The people who are participating in the study and the people who are giving the study both don't know which violin is which.
And that's important because if I know what violin it is and I hand it to you, you might be able to pick up on the cues and my response to you might be different. So
exactly.
I give you the two violins, I have you play them, neither of us know, and then later we find out.
But don't they feel, I mean, if you're the sort of person who can tell the difference between a Stradivarius and another violin,
can
wouldn't you have to have been familiar with the Stradivarius and like understand like the physical feel of the violin is different to play it?
So, for example, they're thinking, oh, is it the varnish that they used? Is that what gives it? It's not like the violin is a different shape.
I guess Bonnie's question is, how can you be double blind if the person picks up and go, oh yeah, Stradivarius? And does the person not, can they not tell? Or are they blindfolded?
Are these people who aren't in the realm of playing that they have come across a Stradivarius, in which case do they just have blunter violin senses?
Well, I'll leave the details of that to the actual study, which will be up on the show page.
Geekspeak.org.
But the people who were playing the violins and evaluating them had very dark, had actually welder's goggles on. So they couldn't pick it up and look at it and say, oh, it says Stradivarius.
Yeah, okay. So, okay, you got it, yeah.
I can't tell.
That's right here.
And the best violins try to copy the Stradivarius perfectly. So I'm assuming look like it's hard to tell.
Yeah. This is actually a follow-up from a previous study that violin players were saying, no, this isn't good enough, you know? So three old Italian violins and three new ones, and then later on it was even a bigger study, 13 violins and 9 old Italian violins, and the study actually showed that the soloists seemed to prefer the new violins.
Busted.
3-2.
Boom. Stradivarius down.
So basically what I'm saying is anytime anyone says, oh, I can tell between an uncompressed audio file and a 256 kbps MP3, I can tell, I want proof. I'm not willing to say, like, no.
I want violin players to listen.
You shouldn't be able to tell.
Yeah.
Do you know how much a Stradivarius viola?
You said I could buy one, so there's got to be under, like, $4,000, because if I did it, I could probably...
Oh, that's a good point. You couldn't buy one.
Oh! Denied me!
One could.
Here are the numbers. The record auction price for a fiddle by a living maker...
Wait, is it legal to say fiddle when you talk about a Stradivarius?
Well, it is on this show.
I'm reading this from the article.
Fiddle away.
$132,000.
Whoa, I couldn't buy one of those at all.
A Stradivarius, $45 million.
What?
So here's my question. How would a violinist ever in their life be able to afford this?
They don't.
They get to play them for life.
Somebody owns one, then they want to hire the best violinist.
How much does it cost to rent a Stradivarius?
See, now I'm going to buy Google Glass for everybody. That's a lot cheaper than a violin.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Lyle.
Makes it okay, right?
Lack of privacy for everyone. All right, Scott from Norwalk, California. You've got warnings for us.
Well, I was wrapped up in your story there about the Stradivarius reminding me of an old Beverly Hillbillies episode. Anyway... I had a website, and for some reason I wasn't able to load my photos right on the server, so I had them on a cloud-based website, and I embedded them into my website, and something happened, and they just deleted the entire account. They went to some other format and a different business model, and now I just have several of my web pages. Just
with broken images?
Oh!
So, I mean, I still have the photos, and I have to go and dig them back out and reload them onto my server. I've switched from the guy who was hosting me before over to GoDaddy. Mm-hmm. That was my second question.
Oh, well, wait. Let's go to your first question. I mean, that's the trouble with trusting a host provider, cloud host provider.
To be the sole owner of your
stuff. Yeah, if you do that, you've got to make sure they've got a business model works. What's the company that did this to you?
Webshots.
Oh, see, it doesn't sound good. They shot you.
It doesn't sound good.
I can recommend a photo hosting site that I use all the time. I link to things all the time. I love it, and it's called SmugMug.
I've heard that through you. Yeah.
Yeah. But it does cost money. You got to spend money on it. So.
You know, and I also take a ton of photos like you do, Lyle, and I've actually gone to just leaving them on the little memory cards.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. As my primary source of storage, and then I have them on my computer, and then I have them on another hard drive.
So you just keep the storage memory sticks around.
Yeah. The sticks are so cheap now. You know, they're like 8 gigs for
might as well, right?
Bucks or something.
Yeah, so and they don't take up much space.
Good, you had a backup.
No, they don't. Actually, you can throw them in a little box and you can get them out of your house. If you're in trouble with an earthquake or a fire, they're easily portable, much easier than a hard drive. And you don't have to worry about them getting dropped or anything, and you know, like a hard drive.
As long as it's not.
My second question was actually about hosting. Like I said, I don't want to make a commercial for them, but I'm through GoDaddy. My registration is somewhere else. The name registration is somewhere else. But I think listening to you guys said that when you register through GoDaddy, they actually own the name that you don't.
So licensing. I personally recommend everybody not to go around GoDaddy. And there's two reasons for that. One, they have had not very good ownership rules in the past. In fact, people have lost domains through GoDaddy.
Yeah, I think they've changed.
They've changed that policy, so they shouldn't do that anymore. But the secondary thing is they do these very sexist commercials. And as a person in tech, it's always a sensitive subject for me. I want the tech industry to understand that being more inclusive is important. And so when you see a sexually clad woman representing a product that's technical based and you're pulling it, it just makes a very aggressive and nasty environment for people. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons I don't do them. That's one of the reasons I always get away from them when I can. But you definitely want to keep your domain names. You want to kind of understand the domain name and who is your registrant, because that relationship is really very powerful. They can take that domain name from you, even if they do it kind of accidentally or if they do it from a legal perspective, whatever. It's your domain name is vulnerable to loss if you don't have a really good relationship with that company.
And that's why it's good to choose a company that you feel you can trust more versus trust less.
Yeah.
So I think Miles actually had a name of a company that you registered
in. I think he uses Joker.
Or something.
Yeah, he uses Joker, I think, or used to. Basically, if what you want to do is you want to look at domain name register it's like you want to look at somebody's a chart about this. I'll try to find it and put it up on geekspeak.org. But basically, you're going to do a Google search for domain registration policy assessments or something, right? And they'll list a whole bunch of domain names, and they'll have a whole bunch of metrics on like what's good and what's bad about them. And you want to look at one that's just completely green on that chart. So I'll put it up on geekspeak.org. But I think I'm not sure which one I like right now.
I use Bluehost, but I'm not saying that they're wonderful, but I didn't find them bad.
I never use the same domain name host as website host. So I've used Dreamhost and I've used Bluehost, and therefore I don't use them as my registers because, so I try to keep separation there. But.
And I got one quick suggestion. You know,
super quick.
Actually, I think we're out.
Backup and it was compressed. What's the difference between backup and copy? Maybe you guys can cover that on another show.
Backup is a second copy.
There we go. Well, this has been GeekSpeak for April 12th, 2014. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you like, but tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit...